Before we begin our second season, we wanted to take a minute to acknowledge the current political moment. To start, we want to state for the record that we both strongly support Black Lives Matter. We also want to be clear that we both take it to be an uncontroversial fact that we live in a white supremacy. This isn't a controversial term in academia, in particular when it comes to critical race theory. It's used to refer to the way that our world is structured, namely that society is built to favor white people. One reason that people resist the term, I think, is that it sounds like we're saying that society is a compilation of white supremacists, as though secretly in our hearts, we actively wish for the dominance of the white race. And that's a very psychologistic way of looking at things and is just inaccurate. Acknowledging that we live in a white supremacy doesn't have anything to do with everyone secretly actively wishing for the oppression of non-whites. In fact, part of the problem is that to white people, the ease we have compared to other races is invisible to us. We don't even notice it, and it seems normal. And just a quick word about privilege. That's not to say that everyone who's white or a man has it easy or is automatically successful. This is a common misconception. We have positive associations with privilege, where often you'll hear people use it in a sentence like, oh, it's such a privilege to be able to do this thing that we're actively grateful for. And so I think part of what trips people up about privilege is that it's not a thing we're registering. And that's part of the problem. What it means is because of your identity, you have had the fewest impediments. That's just a better way to think about it. And it's hard to register because what you don't see is how many more impediments everyone else has because of their gender or their race or their sexuality or their class or their disability or whatever. To begin to reckon with the fact that we live in a white supremacy, we have to be able to question what we see as normal, to question a lot of what we take for granted. That involves a lot of listening, a lot of reading, a lot of watching YouTube lectures and documentaries. We don't have one or two things to unlearn. We have to reorient our sense of the whole picture. That also means questioning which stories we tell and how we tell them. A lot of what we do on this podcast is about questioning the history of male-dominated stories, which mainly relegate women to secondary characters. In the last episode of our first season, we talked about Spike Lee's 1986 film, She's Gotta Have It, and our discussion included mention of the white gaze, which is just as important to keep in mind. Our Western canon has long been held up as significant in part, so the story goes, because it offers a timeless, universal insight into what being human means. The problem is, most of those stories are about white men, and that becomes a problem when we start to see whiteness and maleness as the essential humanity, because other stories seem less universally relevant. How often have you heard a man say, oh, that's a story about a woman, I wouldn't know how to relate to it. Meanwhile, I've never heard a woman say the same thing about a story featuring a male protagonist. What we need to do is question what we find easily relatable, who seems quote-unquote easily likable, and to stretch our imaginations beyond what we take for granted as universal and essential. Women and people of color need to be able to see themselves represented in narratives as protagonists. But just as importantly, white people need to see more narratives with non-white protagonists, and men need to see narratives about women and non-binary people.
Hi, I'm Lisa McEwen.
And I'm Lisa Anita Wagner. And together, we are...
She's Gotta Have It! Exclamation mark! Hello, listeners, and welcome back to another episode of
She's Gotta Have It!
Exclamation mark, in which we talk about the final episode of season two of Fleabag.
Fleabag finale.
I'm really sad, actually. But we can get to that in a minute. Yes, we have joining us today, Kayla Weeb. And Kayla, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Kayla Weeb, and I'm doing my PhD at the University of Toronto and currently taking a leave of absence and working in research at the Hospital for Sick Children in bioethics. I do not have a background in media studies or anything, but I am interested in all things feminism and Fleabag and Phoebe Waller-Bridge in general. Are there other things that people use in their introductions that I'm missing?
That's pretty good.
No, it's perfect. Okay, great. Yeah. And I will just interject. I'm a big fan of the amateur of folks that just like to speak about stuff. So I think that's actually excellent that you're not specifically professional in that front. We just like to have conversations.
Fleabag is actually, I've I think I've had more intentional conversations with people about it than I think any other show. I think it's so interesting. I started watching it because my friend who did go to school for film writing got me to watch it. And she had so many like interesting insights about like how the script was made. So it like helped me see it a bit through that lens. I just think it's a fascinating show.
Interesting. And, yeah. Like, and I'm so interested because I was a theater producer originally and then a film producer. And now it's just a general storyteller. But I think in these ways, a lot. And I feel like it's, you can still really see the shape of the one woman show. However, it is an exceptional piece of filmic storytelling as well. So I think it's just incredible. And we talk about Phoebe Waller-Bridge all the time. I cannot wait for her to get older and have more of a career because I can't imagine what kind of great stuff she's going to do.
It's really exciting.
Yeah. I was just going to just say one thing you had said before too, that this last episode, it is kind of sad. I felt like I don't want the Fleabag universe to be over.
I know. And also it was just so poignant and I was like literally like almost sobbing. Like I was just so moved by the final episode.
Totally cried. I had tears running down my eyes both time I watched it today when he says no to her. And you want so much for him to say yes, but it's the perfect ending. It couldn't be any other way. Yeah. So it's beautiful.
But before we get into the rest of it, should we start with what we want?
Yes.
I, as ever, have not thought about this until just now. So
I heard the voicemail that you guys had from a listener saying they want to get back in touch with what they want. And I thought that was really beautiful. And that resonated a lot.
Actually, this just came to mind. So I will go now. This morning, I woke up at 5 and I felt really refreshed. And I even went all cocky on Facebook. And I was like, I finally feel like I've slept enough because I've been napping so much. And then I slept 2 more 2-hour naps. So I've been leaning into it, like not resisting it. I do have a condition that requires more sleep. And I'm also reworking my core. So there's totally a lot of reason, but I slept for an additional like 11 hours overnight and then 4 hours during the day. So I guess I want to figure out a balance of that to not rock it too hard. Cause you know how oversleeping then, do you know what I mean? Then it becomes like something else, but I'm in an interesting space. So I want to find the perfect balance of a lot of sleep for me. Yeah. That allows just, I guess the best balance of living while allowing myself to rest. Mine's more practical than usual.
And also it is the time of year where I think it's more tempting to sleep more. I have found myself needing a lot of sleep lately and I'm like, am I iron deficient again? Like what's happening? But I think it's just that it's the darkest time of year. We're on 9 month 10 million of this pandemic. And it's not a bad time to lean into restfulness.
Yeah, and I think hibernation, obviously not as for us as humans per se, but I do think that resting in the winter and that resting kind of thing is important. I don't think we do it enough.
And that's actually related to what I want, which I just thought of. So I was listening to a podcast today and this one guy was zooming into the podcast from quote unquote, like a rural cottage in an unknown field in Ireland somewhere. I don't know. It was sort of, he phrased it very jokingly like that. And I remember just thinking like, oh, that's like exactly what I want. And the closest thing I can get to that is that I really want to go to Prince Edward Island and just camp out there for 6 weeks in an Airbnb and just fucking like be on an island without COVID and just hibernate and like see people, which is great, but also be alone and read and meditate and sleep. That's what I want.
That sounds amazing. What do I want? So I had mentioned I'm taking a leave from the PhD. I mean, you probably both know like what being in that kind of academic environment is like. So while I am working, just having the time to turn off, and I've just been amazed at how healthy I feel, I think, which is, it's a weird thing to say when we're going through a global pandemic, like fully recognize like the privilege in that. But I think just mental health wise, just having gotten closer to achieving a kind of balance, I think, in my work life has been, it's like unprecedented for me. So I'm really hoping, I want to pursue that more in the new year and like take that with me when I go back. And of course, I'm already throwing myself into September of next year and freaking out that like I won't be able to, which is not healthy. So I'm like wanting to take things day by day and like maintain this kind of balance.
That's really interesting that you have found that you have felt healthier being outside of academia. I feel like there's a lot of wisdom in that. I am very, very excited to finish my dissertation, which is going to happen sometime in the next 6 months.
Yeah.
I needed to, ask my supervisor if it was okay, if it was still indeterminate, because I want to finish sooner rather than later. But I know that between the winter and the pandemic and just the compiling isolation, I want to just have a work life that is sustainable for me, because I could try and kill myself and run myself into the ground, but I don't think that's going to be sustainable for months and months and months during this time. So I'm hoping to finish by April or May, but it might be June, but I'm so excited to finish and I feel ready to finish. And I feel like my desire to be out of grad school is now overcoming my anxiety about finishing grad school.
Yeah, sometimes I think that's what it takes for that one anxiety to top out the other.
Shall we on to the last flea bag?
Let's do it. And when you ride, call me as you go. Drop to the floor and I
will blow you. I'll pick my way, my fair mistake. Where shall we start?
I know.
I guess I'll just start with that I think I pointed out, because I think it is really cool. And I guess folks that are theater creators and theater lovers and then film folks, because it's so rare, because theater really is a whole different beast and film is a whole different beast. But I find that there's folks that are such authentic storytellers and understand that storytelling medium so well that they can kind of straddle. Because as a theater producer, I really see this as a solid one-woman show. Even the way she calls the characters kind of like bus rodent, like these really kind of almost like glib character names that are kind of like the names that you would see more in a script for a show, like a play, I would say. Mm-hmm. And then the structure of it still really has that, even the way she addresses the audience in this way. But it is so much, like I say, I feel like it's 1,000% an excellent piece of filmic storytelling. So she does this rare thing by keeping the original thing pretty intact, but then pulling it through into another world. So that's just incredible. And I just wanted to sort of start by, I guess, saying that again in terms of her as a storyteller.
Yeah, like there's a real intimacy to it that like I love that you get when you go to see solo shows, which is the thing I always ask Glenn to give me during the Fringe festivals, is I want to see the solo shows, because I find that like, I mean, you can have terrible solo shows, but when they're good, they're like a special kind of transcendental, like amazing. I love the intimacy of the direct address. Like, this is also why I like advice columns, I think. Like, there's just something very powerful to me about, it's almost like, actually, this is what it's like, because I think you'd see more of this if you saw her theatrical version of it. But I do find that solo shows are often best when, or not, and I don't want to make a too strong a statement here. Some of the best solo shows I've seen have been confessionals. It's been a kind of like somebody's harboring a secret and they can't take it. And we're, you know, this sort of faceless audience of like, who are we and what do we represent to the character is sort of ambiguous, but they are confessing this to us because they don't know who else to tell. And that's very much the theme of this series, right? Because she has done something that she thinks is unforgivable and for which she cannot forgive herself, right? Which is sleeping with her best friend's boyfriend and having her best friend spin out and accidentally kill herself. And she can't deal with that. And so it's a way for her to process some of that with us.
What you just described makes sense why that kind of one-woman show would work, because it's not a forced plot point. Because a human gets to that point where you will tell anybody. I was in a breakdown point. I told the cashier my problems at Loblaws, because it really gets to that point. I like that in a one-person show, why that doesn't feel forced. It feels, yeah, I think that can feel very authentic.
And I think that's actually, I mean, in a way, like Daniel MacGyver solo shows are often like this, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's either somebody who's done something terrible or it's a ghost. I mean, he sort of banged that plot point like to death, because there was one point where I was like, is this another show by Daniel MacGyver where it turns out to be a ghost? I just can't. I love that idea, but like, find a new idea. I love you, Daniel MacGyver. I think you're very talented. Please find a new idea. That's what I love about this whole series. And I think why, Lisa, you and I are so drawn to it is because it does manage to translate so much from the theater experience that you only really get if you see really great intimate theater, which is not that most of the theater that people see, right? Like I feel like most of the theater that my friends see are like the sort of big productions. I really love this sort of setting.
And then I guess one other thing that really sticks as a overall point with the whole show is she's able to take things like the fault, like the Roman Catholic priest, like these things that are epic. So if they wouldn't be done executed with such excellence, they would be cliches. So she's carrying these huge sort of story points and these huge things that are very hard to manage, but with excellence, and has it really work. The second series or season, where she's got this priest that's kind of like her mirror that she's sort of falling in love with. It's like genius. But if someone else would have tried it, it could end up being very two-dimensional, one-woman show kind of thing that they're trying, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. So it's her epicness and her authenticity, her ability to carry epicness through authenticity, mm-hmm. I think is incredible.
With his character too. I mean, I'm your guys' friend who has like seen Wicked in theater, but like not much else.
Oh, right, yeah.
So like not a lot of like, so the excellence you're talking about seeing in like really good one woman shows or one people shows, one person shows, of course, like my contact with that is with Liebig. But in thinking through like the character of the priest too, I think like she achieves a lot of him not being reduced to like mm-hmm. a caricature by like not naming him, by like, there's just like an air of mystery around him in that way. And like, there's so much silence between them too. I mean, she does that with herself too. Like, I think the show's about like being known.
Being seen, like she, yeah. he see, that's what's so exciting. They see each other. And that's why I think I cried when he says no to her at the end, or not like closes mm-hmm. the door at the end.
No, I always bawl my eyes out in this episode. Like his speech about love, like he says, you know, it's hard to say anything original about it, but that's the part that always gets me.
I mean, like that, I think I wrote down a note that was like, I wish like if more sermons had been like that when I was a kid going to church, I would have been like, this is awesome. Let's come every week. Because Kayla, what you were saying about how there's like an air of mystery around him. There is, but at the same time, he's so incredibly human. Mm-hmm. And like the weird specific fallibility, like he's freaked out by foxes and he spills on himself. And
uncomfortable around babies.
And he also does stuff that's like slightly inappropriate sometimes. Like he says the wrong thing, or he swears and he smokes. But there was something about that sermon that was just so raw and like unpolished in a way that I think when I associate, you know, a priest standing up and giving a sermon or a speech, that there's something that tends to be a bit too just so about it, or just too neat, you know? Mm-hmm.
I think that goes to that authenticity again, because he was, that was the best he could do about talking about love in that moment of where he was at. So again, it's truthfulness. And he's always still sticking within the churchy rules, I believe, and Kayla can speak to this better, or with whatever works for him. But it's so truthful that kind of like transforms it or something into something different that's for a wider audience, because you're drawn to the authenticity of him.
Kayla, at any moment you can just like burst in guys, I'm going to talk. So for example, this is something that really bugs me about philosophy as well. So I don't want to like, you know, harp on religion, because I do think that I've also seen a lot of old white men in philosophy try to talk about love. And I'm like, and it's like this weird, idealized, rosy posy version of what love is. And it's just like, that's sort of what you'd expect to hear at a wedding. And I always just find myself rankled by that and just thinking like, is that your experience of the world? Because let's go ask your wife, because I feel like she might have a couple things to say. Not that, you know, they aren't capable of love, but that they aren't capable of really reflecting on the kind of like gross messiness of their own like lived experience of it. And so they get stuck in these philosophical ideas about it and these Platonic ideals about it, and they don't like really think about the fact that it's also terrifying, which is what he's saying, right? Like, why the fuck would anyone want to do that on their own? You need, you know, you need to kind of be partnered with somebody in some respect to deal with it, to deal with the destabilizing force that it is.
What's weird about when philosophers, or I think like anyone who tries to say, like, so you hear this in, well, I, you know, haven't been to a wedding all year because, you know, the things that people say at weddings that I've been to when they're in churches are always so, Lisa, like you said, idealized, but I also, it strikes me as detached, which makes no mm-hmm. sense, because like each person's experience of love is so, it's so particular and it has to be so personal. And I just, anything you can say about love that's general ends up sounding trite, but somehow he manages to talk about the things that actually are common about love, like that it is destabilizing and terrifying and all anybody wants, and it's hell when we get there. Like, I love that line so much. He's speaking to a very, like a really, like love in the context of really messy, broken people. And he is one of those messy, broken people, which isn't what love is supposed to be, right? It's supposed to be this thing that is not negative, is not like, you know, painful. But I love that he just speaks it out loud that it is. I know at least that you would ask me, like, you know, because I have some like background in religion, but this is also what I find like really difficult about his character. And this is why I really wanted to hear your guys' episode on the fourth episode, because I was like, I need to know what you guys think about the confessional scene. Because what I love about his character as a priest is that he is this, he's not what you expect, he's not detached, he's very authentic and quirky and weird, and he has vices kind of on display. And his approach to his brokenness seems to be, oh, like I'll just, it's out in the open, which I think can be really good. But then he's also occupying a position of authority, and he has, you know, the structure of the Catholic Church, like he has, you know, like a flock or like a congregation of people who look to him. And there is this expectation that someone in that position is fully healed, not so they can be this like, I'm perfect and you're not, but so they don't abuse their power, which, as we know, like lots of people just do. I saw the scene in the confessional booth, and I'm sorry, I know this isn't like the we're supposed to talk about, as like kind of an abuse of that power, and it really rubbed me the wrong way, and it was just really difficult to navigate. I like this person in this role because he's authentic and messy, but also this seems to be exactly why people in those positions aren't allowed to be that. So I wanted to hear what you guys thought about that. Does that make sense?
It totally makes sense. And it's interesting, as you talked it through, I think that Phoebe Waller-Bridge used that. I feel like it's probably deliberate on her part, and I just like it. It makes it even richer for me that he did, again, like, yeah, he's crossing all the lines, doing his best, but that I didn't notice that when I watched it, because I guess that wasn't, yeah, that just wasn't in my sort of way I was thinking about it. But yeah, that's, I totally agree with what you say in terms of that abuse of power in that moment.
Well, because like she even says before the moment, she's like, well, what, I'm going to tell you all my secrets and then you're going to use them against me, which like her family has done, right? Like in the previous season, her sister and Martin use her, you know, transgressions with Boo's boyfriend to use it against her and say like, well, why wouldn't you make a move on my husband? Like you've done it before. And then like, he doesn't do quite that, but he gets her to a place of complete vulnerability. And she talks to him the way she's only spoken to us. And then he just, you know, tells her like, it just, oh, and then he walks away because the photo falls down, as, and that's like a reference to like, oh, well, like I've got God's endorsement. Yeah. But then she's left feeling bad, as if like, his transgression is her responsibility. And I just think it's so messed up, but like, then I love him again. It's so confusing.
I have a few thoughts about, oh, sorry. Go ahead, Lisa.
No, I was just going to say, the more I heard you talk through it, I think it's such genius storytelling using all that stuff really well. That's all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We did talk about this scene in detail, and I feel like I totally see why it bugs you so much. I think I so want them to get together that I just didn't care about that part.
Me too.
But okay. So here's what I remember saying on episode 4, and calling back to other episodes is totally fine. If people don't want to hear it again, they can fast forward. But I do think revisiting even things we've already talked about, you know, with your perspective is a really valuable thing. So there was a couple of things. Yeah. So first of all, when he said, get down on your knees, I was like, this is taking a very creepy direction. Like the very first time I saw it, like I do feel a bit like grossed out by that.
Yeah.
But then he gets down on the ground with her. Mm-hmm. And that's what saves that scene for me, because it also contrasts so starkly with the psychiatrist or the therapist scene, right? Because the thing about a therapist, especially with a lot of kinds of therapy, is that they are trying to be neutral and they are trying to be impersonal, because it's not like a friend relationship. It's supposed to be about you examining yourself, which includes you examining the ways you project things onto other people. And if you know too much about your therapist, it's harder and harder to see what it is you're projecting onto them. Yeah. But it does end up being this really difficult relationship to navigate, because it's very artificial. And also the therapist ends up like sort of seeming like this sort of untouchable person who doesn't have a personality and seems like in a weird way, kind of like a priestly figure, like just a sort of neutral authority or in some way like depersonalized. And what was so interesting to me about this scene is that he is so personalized. Not only like is she on the ground, he gets on the ground with her and they're kind of there together. Mm-hmm. And it feels like in a weird way, like that's kind of like what, like she kind of like just that, just to say that, like she needs somebody to be on the ground with her, mm-hmm. right? Because she's felt so and has been so scapegoated by her family the whole time, right? Because they fucking love to hate her because then they don't have to look at their own imperfections, right? Yeah. And they can't deal with it in the first episode of this season when she actually sort of has her shit together and they're like, why are you being like this? And she's like, being like what?
Doing nothing. And they're like, why? Yeah.
And then he kisses her. And I agree that there's a transgression there, but Lisa, I think you're kind of right. Like that's what makes a really great storytelling because he's sinning, right? Like he's doing something he shouldn't. Just like she always is doing stuff that she shouldn't, mm-hmm. like they both are transgressing. I mean, I think it would be different if she were a real parishioner, but I don't really feel like she is. She's kind of there because she has a crush on him and he knows that, right? And it reminds me a lot. So there's one person I've been kind of recently obsessed with, Kayla, and maybe you know of her, I don't know. But like I heard her interviewed on a podcast and then I looked up every podcast she's ever been on. Nadia Boltzweber.
I love her, yes.
My God. And I love the way she talks about what it means to her to be a Lutheran minister. And she's like, I'm not perfect. Like my first reaction is fuck you.
I love her. Yes.
And so obviously her role as a minister is like one thing and who she is like a bit of another thing. But like there is a humanity to the way she talks about what it means to think about God and religious themes. And I've just like been kind of obsessed with her, especially it felt like thematically appropriate for the Christmas season.
Oh, nice. I haven't listened yet, but it's interesting because the little history that I have with church, my family is Lutheran and that's the confirmation class I got kicked out of was Lutheran. And there were some things that I liked about that church. So I'm extra keen to listen to that.
That's podcast. So badass that you got kicked out of confirmation class.
And the thing is, I'm not a badass person. And it's interesting to think back to what I did. I said I wanted to be an actress. I think that the man running the church that I was involved in had some additional mental health problems. Like my parents drove me to church. It's in Kensington Market at that time when I was little. Yeah. It was kind of rough. He's like, God gave you legs, you should walk. So that seemed like his own idea. I don't know. Like having a kid walk to Kensington Market seems dumb, right? That was like kind of wrong. And then I wanted to be an actress and he said, that's a sin. And I was like, okay. And then I really liked Boy George, busted the shirts, like was really into Boy George and that super ticked him off. And he's like, maybe you shouldn't come back. And I was like, maybe I shouldn't come back.
It sounds like he did you a favor. Yeah. That's wild. Lisa, because now I'm like, this is just the way my brain works, but it's like, this is why I struggle with the priest's character so much because like my immediate reaction to Nadia Boltzweber is like, oh my gosh, like fully obsessed. I love her so much because she's human, right? So I've said, you know, part of the priest's attraction is that he's like, you know, he has humanity, he's humble, he's messy. But then like, I worry that that can lead to an abuse of power. But then I also think that maintaining this weird air of perfection, like has also led to abuses of power. And it's actually humanity that we want from people who are in positions of leadership. And this is just in general why I find institutionalized religion genuinely confusing and just like impossible.
Yeah.
But people like her seem to do it in a way where I'm like, I think I could participate in that if that's what it looked like.
I was just going to interject because I have just a real world experience. One of my high school friends who was the last person you would expect, I remember meeting her for coffee once and she said, I'm a priest and she runs a church at Runnymede now. Mm-hmm. And I've met with her a bunch of times and I just had so little experience with that, but she has her congregation and she literally is like, what do you guys need this week? So she literally helps folks with whatever they need this week or this day. And I remember I was like, whoa, this is like how it's supposed to be. Yeah. So that just blew my mind. Alexa Gilmore, and it's the church at Runnymede in the West End. But I remember just the simplicity of like need and help mm-hmm. and assistance and community was just really pure there.
And so Nadia Boltzweber talks about this famous interview she did where she talked to Lance Armstrong. And apparently people at this conference were coming up to her the day that she was going to interview him and saying like, you know, just really just like nail him, just like get him. She's like, you realize I'm a minister, not a journalist, right? Like, And so the first thing she says to him is something like, you know, Lance, I see from my notes that you took a bunch of drugs you shouldn't have and you lied about it. And she's a recovering addict, right? Like she's been in recovery for like almost 30 years or something.
Yeah.
And or 20 years. And she's like, oh my God, I did that so many times, right? And what effect that had on him specifically in that moment, she says, is that it like disarmed him beyond maybe like what he'd been capable of in previous interviews.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's what I like. That's like, you know, if there was anyone who was going to reach Fleabag, I feel like it's going to be somebody who admits their like, and just doesn't admit it in a kind of like, look at me admitting all my failures, but actually fucking fucks up in front of her in this way. And that's not the only time he does that, right? Like, I mean, just, you know, right from the beginning, he comes out and smokes and then he's like, well, fuck you then. And she's like, she turns back and she's like, okay, now you have my attention. You know, he's got a kind of like, you know, in his own insecurities and he's got his own kind of whatever.
And he doesn't try to cover them at all. At all. Like he just will be sitting them and kind of look at you with his open eyes, you know what I mean? And then go, oh, like I can't talk to babies or I don't do this or I go to bed at 8 o'clock or any of the things. So yeah, there's no even like toe in the water of trying to cover, which is very rare in the world in general, I think.
No, you guys have convinced me. I was like really disturbed and now I feel a lot better about it.
Good.
Oh, good. I think you're totally right. This story is about like her character arc. And if someone were to approach her with any, even if they were sincerely like, oh no, I have very few flaws. Like we all know people like that and it is sincere and it's incredibly annoying. She needed to have someone who was like on her level.
Pushing, yeah. Because she pushes a lot in the small and in the big. And I think it was well crafted. I think it was deliberately crafted. If that would have been made, but not by Phoebe Waller-Bridge, could have been different. Well, I'll just quickly interject. When you guys were talking about Lance Armstrong, before it clicked in, I was like the astronaut Lance Armstrong, like the first guy on the moon. And I was like, whoa, he took all these drugs. So anyway, just an aside.
No, he was he was a cyclist.
Yes. Yeah. I did put the proper Armstrong to the proper story. Putting yourself on the same level as someone, like saying like that I was in that same place, I do think has a huge human connecting thing. If it's real, not unless it's like, you know, a fake thing, but if it's a real thing and you're like the priest or like this lady you're talking about who I have not yet heard, but I feel like I will also like that authenticity and showing up in the moment for someone is so huge. And when it's mixed with anything, it's really appealing and human, I think.
And she's talked about how after Black Lives Matter happened, she had a bunch of, I mean, she's not necessarily like she's not necessarily exemplary of what Lutheran ministers are like, Lisa, as you found out in your Sunday school. She's like, a whole bunch of my colleagues were like, well, I hope everyone's gonna be preaching against Nazis. And she's like, is the bar on the ground? Why are like good for you for preaching against Nazis? And I think the sermon she gave that week was something like, here are all the ways I've benefited from white supremacy, like personally. I love that. Like that's what I'd want in a minister of a church I went to if I ever were to end up in one ever again.
It's like the opposite of like white fragility that's really like embarrassing. It's like owning it straight off the bat. Very impressive.
I had a question. Lisa, when you had first reached out to me to come on here and chat with you guys, you had mentioned that, and this might've come up in previous episodes, that youth think this story is about Fleabag's redemption, and you were like curious as to like the role that faith specifically had in that. So like after finishing the series or the season, like with that lens, like how do you see the faith element fitting in? You know, it's like obviously a very intentional choice to have like a priest. Even though it's funny, like it starts off like his presence in their lives is really shallow window dressing. Like the stepmom's like, oh, like how, like I don't know, did she say like not chic, fancy, but how chic?
How chic it is.
And like to her, it's like, oh, this like, you know, locally sourced mason jar with sand. Like that's who he is.
It's an aesthetic for her. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. But then he comes in and his faith is obviously a huge part of his relationship to Fleabag. But how do you see that working for Fleabag specifically at the end of it all?
That is a good question and one that I hoped you would answer. And so, I have thoughts on that too.
Okay, good.
We'll do a round table. Started occurring to me in season one. I mean, this happens to me all the time. Like the first time I watched it, it's not like it escaped me, but like when I'm watching in order to talk about something or to write a review about something, my brain turns on a little bit more, which is what I love about this podcast, because it makes me just watch things very actively and intentionally. It's very clear to me that she has just like lost faith in herself as a person, as someone. She could, like, she can't trust herself. She doesn't feel lovable. And the first season is really about her kind of falling like deeper and deeper into that pit of despair as she like denies the thing, like she kind of can't face the thing that she thinks she's done to Boo. I mean, like, what she did was terrible, but she's doing that thing that, like, you know, everyone does when they have a close person die, which is they blame themselves.
Yeah,
right. And that's a very natural thing to do, even if you have nothing to do with their death.
Yeah.
And like, I've maybe said this before. I can't remember if I've said this on this podcast, but I feel in some weird ways guilty and responsible for my father's death. And he had pancreatic cancer. Like, I had nothing to do with it. And I still kind of have that guilt of survivor's guilt, right? And so yeah. I can only imagine if you're any link in the causal chain of somebody's death, like how easy it is to just put the blame on yourself, right? And so she's being scapegoated by her family, but she's also kind of, I don't know, persecuting herself. And this season seems to me to be about her figuring out a way, despite this thing that she thinks is unforgivable, figuring out how to have faith in herself and also to forgive herself. These are interesting sorry, I'm going to get real intellectual up in the space. Okay. I'm such a nerd. I really kind of started nerding out about when I started listening to all this Nadia Boltzweber and then also just thinking about this in terms of Fleabag is that philosophy doesn't really have room for these concepts. I mean, Derrida talks about like the weird paradox of unforgivability, and half of philosophy kind of laughs and says he's like being such an arrogant moron or whatever. There is a paradox about unforgivability because like in order to bridge that gap, you do often have to forgive something that you don't have to do that by definition, right? It's not like there's a straightforward logic to faith or to love or to forgiveness. You have to make a kind of leap. And she doesn't know how to do that on her own. And she kind of can't do it on her own, right? She needs to find somebody to reflect that back to her. And I was looking up the etymology of redemption today because this is also the kind of nerd I am. And I remember a podcast where Nadia Boltzweber said something about redemption and then I couldn't find it again. And it wasn't what I found when I looked up the etymology, which is like, you know, to buy back, because I think that has really capitalist tones to it, but I don't know that that's necessarily the spirit of the root of the word. But it seems like what she needed was a kind of equalizing force or a kind of exchange, which is what she discovers when, you know, he doesn't choose her, but he loves her. And that gives her back as that, like, enough to kind of be able to like love herself again. And I think that that is her redemption, is that he helps her find her way back there. And so she doesn't get the romantic love, but she gets the self-love back, which is like the gift that he gives her, is what I think her redemption is, right? Is him helping her to do that for herself.
And actually that really mirrors sort of how I feel about it, which just is sort of a slightly different framework, but I feel like she also, like lost faith in kind of everything by the end of season one, really. She had no allies. Like, I felt so bad for her. Besides her lovers, which were really sort of thin allies, she didn't really have any allies after Boo had passed away. And then I think the only thing she knows is through the gateway of a man, like of a lover. So the priest showed up and she had to put it through the gateway of a lover. She didn't know what to do with it. And then through that is how she kind of was able to trust herself, find herself again. Like, so I feel like it's very similar to how you just laid that out.
As to my thoughts about it, I think that him being a priest, like a Catholic priest specifically, is so, okay, let me just say this. When you ask me like this question that I just asked back to you rudely, what do you think? Like, what does faith have to do with it essentially? I was so struck by it because I had never thought about it in that way, because I think, so I do think you're totally right that it's about her like redemption, however we cash that out. But I think him being like this priest is kind of a red herring, because I don't think, she obviously doesn't find faith in that specific way.
Right.
I think what she does find, and I think this is consistent with what you both have been saying and reflecting on, like, I think she finds faith in herself. I think she like is gaining some of that trust back. I also think that she understands that she can be seen and still loved, right? Mm-hmm. Because the whole arc and fragmentation of like the first season, and the way like most of the beginning of this season is filmed is like sharp, like 15 million different camera angles in like 30 seconds, just like really, really fragmented. So like you never get the whole story. And the scenes with her and him are filmed much more slowly. Like there's pauses are allowed. There's like a few different camera angles and like you just have to sit in it. And then obviously he sees her going away to talk to us and he's like, where are you going? And she, that's never happened to her before. Mm-hmm. And I think reflecting on my own experiences, like that is incredibly uncomfortable, right? Like when someone's actually seeing you and like not projecting on you, like you're like, oh my God, get the fuck away. Like, what are you doing? Like, no, I think it's this fear that, you know, she takes the blame, you know, rightly or wrongly for this thing that's happened and she doesn't feel like she's worthy of love. And I think even though, you know, this relationship doesn't work in the ways that we really wanted to. it's sad for her and it's heartbreaking. I don't know. I had this sense of like, you learn that you can love and that will work out differently. And like, you're not broken by it and someone can see you and still love you and still choose not to be with you. You're still worthy of love, if that makes sense. And that is technically what the Christian gospel says, right? Like, so if I, you know, sort through all the institutional garbage and like just nonsense of a lot of what my experiences have been, the truth of the matter, like the person of who Jesus is and probably like what Nadia Bolz-Weber and like people like her talk about and try and embody it, that is the whole thing, is that we're all messy, but like we're all worthy of love. And like, that's unconditional. That doesn't change. And it actually doesn't matter what you've done. So I think there is like, so maybe it's not completely a red herring, but I also think that's like, that's universal, like that, whether you believe in this kind of God or that kind of God, I think that's true of human beings in general. I mean, I think there could be counterexamples. Yeah. So I saw her redemption in that kind of way of like, you can be seen and you'll survive and you'll actually learn to like, look at yourself and love yourself.
Yeah.
I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, no, that's, yeah. You're picking up on a few things that I didn't talk about, but is definitely consistent with what I was trying to say. Yeah. And I do think so much stuff in this series, some of her choices are kind of like half jokey, but half kind of like meaningful. And I feel like the priest, the choice of him being a priest is sort of a bit jokey, but also she is bringing in, I think, some Christian themes that we've sort of lost in secular society. And that she did need to access in order to get back up from where she was.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to defend Christianity too much. It's been like not a great force in our history.
But sure.
Like, and I think like other, you know, traditions have like arrived at this like maxim of like,
oh, for sure.
And like all that kind of stuff, obviously. Another question I had for you guys is like, she starts the second season by saying this is a love story. So like, what do you make of that having finished it like at the last episode? Because she doesn't address it again.
I think it's the first love story that we've seen since Boo died in the time frame. I just thought of that the moment you asked, but I do think that because she did purely love him and he purely loved her the way she purely loved Boo. So yeah, not non-sexual. There was sexual, but
yeah,
like just pure love.
I mean, it strikes me that it is a love story. It doesn't need to end happily in order to be a love story. Sure, and it's certainly more of a fucking love story than Romeo and Juliet, which,
oh my goodness.
Don't get me started on how people are like, it's a great love story. What? No,
it's the worst. I hate it with all my heart.
And it's also a good red herring that it looks like it might go a different way with some sex romp with the priest. Do you know what I mean? It opens it up to this realm of possibility.
But that there's multiple meanings, right? Because he also decides that his first love is God, and she also falls back in love with herself in a way, like not in a romantic way, but just it is a story about, and I mean, you know, there's small ways this comes out with other characters too, because she kind of reaches a peace with Claire. Like they're never going to be great friends, they're so different, but they really kind of had more of a solidarity during this.
Yeah. And I mean, season. She finishes the episode saying like, you're the only person I'd run through an airport for.
Yeah.
It's the sweetest thing that's ever going to come out of Claire's mouth. Like it is. Lisa, something you said about it manifesting in different characters too. I think like she reaches part of that with her dad as well. Like she has this role as the scapegoat and this problem, or like what he says, like being naughty or something in her family. But then she, it's in a flashback at the funeral, I think, or in the attic. I'm forgetting now, but I think she gets a little bit of closure of, you know, you're a lot like your mom, right? So like, mm-hmm. this thing that she is and her family, she's like taken as, oh, this is bad. And like, they're not nice about it. Like, I'm not condoning this behavior, but to hear that, like, oh, this was something that you, that your mother was like as well. And to be like, oh, like, well, I love my mom and she's actually the person I want here. And I can be that and it's okay. Like, again, this kind of self-acceptance.
And that, like, you know, it also opens up like a whole bunch of questions for me about, well, is part of the reason that the father finds it difficult to relate to Fleabag is because she reminds him too much of his late wife and that's hard for him.
That's what I think. Although he did say to her in this episode, you're the one that's the most capable of love in this family. Mm-hmm. So quite big compliments to Fleabag, really slipped in there in the way this family does.
Yeah.
Compliments.
And she's like, I don't find it hard. And like, you know, the whole series has been about how hard she finds it.
I guess she felt insulted. You know, even if you know you do something and then someone in your family tells you do it, it's that sort of insultingness about it because you don't want to be called on it.
Yeah. It also reminds me of that moment where she and her father are on the floor in the kitchen and the stepmother comes in and is trying to like join. And so that moment gets interrupted when they're like laughing and eating food off the floor or something.
Yeah.
A few episodes ago. And in this one, it reminded me of that, except it didn't get interrupted. Right.
And then it's nice because even the stepmother gave her said thank you for finding the father. So it is actually nice. She got probably the kindest moment she's ever going to get from the godmother and two big compliments from her sister and her dad. I didn't actually realize that until we had this conversation. Mm-hmm. It was slipped in, but they're there.
She gets to take the statue back once again.
Oh my God. That's so great. That's the best little button on the very end of it. And then the fox. That's like a double button.
He went that way.
Aww. And hit the detail of him being like really afraid of foxes was also so adorable and funny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I didn't realize that foxes were what our raccoons are, but in England, like I had, they're a wild animal to me, but they are there all the time.
Yeah. That makes sense. That makes sense.
Because my parents have foxes in their neighborhood and it's almost like this good luck thing to see one because they basically live in the valley. So yeah. Okay. So they're more like vermin and they're more aggressive over there kind of thing.
Yeah. I think like comparable to raccoons, right? So like kind of cute, but you know, they just are in everyone's trash bins. And I watched an interview with Phoebe Waller-Bridge and she said that, yeah, like they rule the night basically. Like it gets dark and the foxes come out to play in London.
And they probably won't hurt you, but also you never know when one's going to be aggressive.
Yeah.
God, I have a long history with raccoons. Again, my parents lived like right by this ravine. So they would break into my door. They'd jump into my bed. Like I was so afraid of them and their little burglar hands with their little, like they have little gloves. They would climb into my bed. Oh my God. It was so scary.
They would climb into your bed?
Yes. So my parents, this house is, again, it's right up a hill. And I had this big tree that like kind of came up to my balcony too. So it was like a highway for raccoons. I had a cat and the cat's food was in my room. So the raccoons would really work ripping screens. They broke a metal thing, get in to steal my cat's food. And I don't know why they came on the bed. That was like my nightmare. Just one, not they. I make it sound like there's more, but one raccoon. And I just screamed at my mom. She's like, what do I do? He's like, I don't know. What do I do? But it was like, he was staring at me. So she got some pots and pans and started banging them. I was like, oh my God, he's going to like rip me in the face. Anyway, he laughed. They're intense. Anyway. That's so terrifying. I guess. So with that in mind, again, foxes seem more benign to me. They don't seem quite that kind of weirdly aggressive. It seemed like that raccoon was like out to get me, like I'd hurt his sister or something, the way he was like eyeballing me and coming closer into my bed. So living in a ravine is very romantic, but for things like raccoons feeling comfortable in your house, it's a bit nerve-wracking.
And so the last thing I have here that I just wanted to talk about was the fact that she waves off the camera and like she doesn't want it to follow her, which I don't know if anyone had complicated thoughts about, but I feel like that just sort of, it goes back to what you were saying, Kayla, which is that, you know, she feels like she's been seen and known in a real way. And so she doesn't need the function that the audience was serving anymore.
Like in one way, it's really weird because again, this like love story, like doesn't go the way like that we would expect it to go conventionally, but it also like it's just the way it had to. So you might wonder, why isn't she more broken and like all this kind of stuff? But I think the function the audience also plays is to like distract her from dealing with her pain, right? Like she gets, which we all do in any of our various immature or mature coping mechanisms, you know, the thing like we're not vulnerable all the time. It gets to a place, I think, where it's, you know, a barrier to you actually like confronting something that needs to be like grappled with for you to be healthy. And I think hers is obviously humor and sarcasm and things like that. And so with us, like she's been able to interject like in every single conversation she cuts up to talk to us to, you know, either show her dominance, like she knows exactly what they're going to say and she's often right and all this kind of stuff. Right. So I think like, part of being healthy is not needing to do that anymore. So that's kind of how I took that as like a step in her healing, is that she doesn't need to be like pathologically performative.
I think that's exactly how I saw it too. I thought it was a kind of nice ending that just rounded it out nicely, but there was still a lot of room. I don't think it's going to come back necessarily, but it was just that nice kind of realm of possibility was still there. Do you know what I mean? Because he said, don't come to the church, but he'd said that before and she still went. Do you know what I mean? So you know that there's still more days for them to do more things. In that moment, she's like, I don't need you anymore. I think that that is huge. I think him seeing her even for those few moments and that one night of sex, that kind of like healed her, and not in the weird way, like someone sex heals someone, but you know what I mean? The BC is what it is.
Surely you guys, like, I mean, I have past partners where things have like ended in a very sad way, but that on reflection, I look back and I think like, there's a lot that that person contributed to my life that I feel really grateful for and to some aspect of a journey for me, you know, fuck, that happened to me last year. So I think that that's, you know, like the best way to move on when something doesn't work out. It doesn't mean that it failed. It just means like it's over. And one of the things you can do is carry it with you, not just like the resentment and the pain, which sometimes also is there for a while, but also hopefully when that falls away, there's whatever that person meant to you and what they contributed to your life.
Yeah. I think that like thinking about relationships that end or don't last forever, however you want to think about it, as a failure is so wrong, right? Like when you get into romantic entanglement, like whatever, even if it's like just whatever category it is, right? Like you are together until you break up or you die. Like those are the only options, right? And like you can't be with everybody forever. Like it's just not gonna work. And it
gets so busy.
Too much going on. So yeah, I like the permission to just allow things to not, I don't even want to use the words like work out, because that's normatively laden as like a success story, but like not to continue on in the ways that we're taught to think they have to. And that can still be a really good thing.
Yeah. Like it can be a love story, but they don't end up together.
Yeah, but absolutely.
Like mixed feelings about it. Like, is the mixed feeling like, no, we want Fleabag to continue. Like, I can't be over. Or like, do you have more thoughts about that? Or
I don't think I have a lot of like, I don't think I have any particularly like negative thoughts about it. I think I just had a few different ideas about what it could mean. And I think that that kind of came out in our discussion. So, cause you guys filled in some of that for me that I sort of had like the back of my mind, but I wasn't sure. I don't like, I mean, it's sort of, you know, I like what you said, Kayla, about her not needing to be pathologically performative, because it's almost the way sometimes people use social media, right? Yeah. Twitter or Instagram. It's like, look how sarcastic I can be. Like, look how smart I am. And it's like, oh my God, that's exhausting. You know, I don't necessarily find myself on there a lot when I'm feeling good about my life. not that, I mean, and I don't want to say that all social media use is pathological. It certainly isn't. But I do think that it can provide that kind of performative function where you're, where you are putting something out into an audience that can't really reply to you, or it can't really respond in the way that he does, right? Where he's like, stop doing that. Like where are you going? Like what is
social media is just a whole, there can be entire podcasts just about what that is. But I think like even, so to your point, absolutely. But even in our own lives, like we surveil the things we say to other people. It's like banal to be like, we're all performative all the time. Like, sure. Okay. But like some people achieve authenticity and that is real, but like it's finding that like line between the two, or even when it's like appropriate to be vulnerable, because it's not all the time. Sorry, Lisa, not McEwen. I don't actually know your last name. I'm so sorry.
Oh, my name is Lisa Wagner.
Lisa Wagner. Okay. So not to nerd out super hard on philosophy inside baseball, but I used to be really attracted to this idea of like selfhood as like narratives, and until I understood like how deeply deceptive and like manipulative they can be, right? Like this, I think in one sense, we are the stories we tell other people, because like that's what's available to them. But in another sense, being that controlled all the time, like that, like Lisa said, like it's exhausting. And surely we would want people around where we don't have to have that kind of front up constantly. And those are the very people that we trust and we can be seen by and all that kind of stuff.
Cool. Well, that was, that was a great and very exhaustive, not exhausting, but exhaustive discussion. Like, I think we covered everything that I wanted to talk about personally.
Now we can end just on the how we're going to be sad that Fleabag is over.
By rewatching it constantly.
Well, yeah, I mean, I personally, because for me, watching stuff is really about the feeling of it. I rewatch stuff a million times. Like the show Transparent, I think I've watched the series about 35 times because it brings me this feeling of comfort and joy. I'm gonna watch it a lot. And Lisa and I have sort of talked about this, partially joking, but not really, that maybe I feel like we're gonna probably do this long term, this podcast. It could be cool, say in 10 years or however that looks, to revisit something like Fleabag and just see how it might, and maybe not every episode, maybe like one for each season or something, just to revisit something as rich as this and see what time might bring as well.
No, I think that's really great. Like, we don't live in a society where it's like okay to change our minds or to like grow, and I think like our room for that all the time is amazing. There's no like analysis here. I just wanted to say, like, one of my favorite moments is when Martin's like, "You have to beg me to leave you," and then she does. So like, I just that's so happy. It's just the perfect, "Well, fuck you then," and she's like, "Well, fuck you," or whatever. Like when she just says like that's their goodbye, it just brought my heart so much joy. Like, finally, goodbye.
I know Claire is so serious about that moment, and her little face, she had the same look on her face as when she came to with the hair style. She said, "I look like a pencil." That was the same look she gave Martin when she's like, "Please, please leave me. I look like a pencil." Like, it was like, it's just her deepest distress and biggest pleading.
No, it's so good.
I adore Claire. Oh my God. And the fact, I can't remember. Did she leave the wedding to go find Claire? I don't remember if she actually left. She did. Yeah. Oh good. I'm so glad. I loved Claire.
She even takes out her hair extension to be
that's right.
This way, and then she runs away.
I'd had a block on that. She leaves her hair extension.
Which is in a small way, a kind of like symbolic gesture to like what Fleabag's doing, right? Like she's taking off this mask she's wearing. And she's just going to run after this guy because she doesn't care about how things look anymore. Such a great show. So many, like, it just all kind of ties together and so neatly and so artistically.
Completely brilliant. Have you guys seen the stage, like the kind of first iteration of this ever?
I have not.
I really want to. I have not. But I know it gets shown in theater sometimes, and I really hope to get tickets at some point to see that.
Cool. Well, thank you, Kayla, for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I love this medium. I love that podcast exists right now. Like, it's the content we all need.
Yeah,
I'm happy to chat with you guys about such a wonderful show.
Awesome. Thanks for being part of our community.
Now that we've said it,
we've got
to get it.
Woo! That's where I clap my own hands together. Yeah.
Go ahead. And when you ride,